Welcome back to Defrag. I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
And we're here to answer your tech support questions. We've got a few questions today. Let's just dive right into this. From the comments on last week's show, we've got one from Dave Will. Is there a way to tweak Windows Mobile Device Center or Windows interaction with it to tighten up the time span between when the device is recognized by window, doink, doink, and when connectivity to the device is actually viable? We've seen 10 to 15 second delays between these two points in time, and end users are confused by it.
That one's kind of an interesting question because it'll vary by machine.
Yeah.
Everything about when you plug in a device is event-driven, so it'll depend on, hey, has the user plugged it into that port before? Does the system even know about it? Is it installing a driver for it?
Is this the first time for this device?
Exactly. So. If users are, you know, choosing a different port, for example, then, you know, Windows has to go through an additional recognition process to say, oh, this is actually a known device, but it's on a different port. I don't
really
need to install.
I wondered about that before, because like my card reader, I just use the same port every time.
Mm-hmm. That's usually the best way to do it.
Yeah.
Or if you don't care about that, take your device the very first time, plug it into each of your ports, make sure that everything is golden, and then it won't matter which port that you plug
it
into.
That's really interesting. I'd thought about that before, but I figured once the device is, you know, got its drivers and everything, it's all configured and it
doesn't
matter.
For the most part, that's true.
Yeah.
You know, it is, we try, where we definitely don't just reinstall the same driver over and over again.
Yeah, sure.
But we have to know that, oh, this is a different port than what we remember it being on.
Yeah. You know. And so cutting that time down, I mean, one of the things that they could do is leave the Windows Mobile Device Center up, and
or
then it doesn't have to start.
Yeah.
So that's going to save you a little bit of time there. But I don't think we can speed up the amount of time between when you hear the recognition of the USB device connecting and when the software sees the device and it's talking to it.
Right. It's kind of it's a fudge factor in terms of how long it'll take. It depends on what the machine is doing at the time, what other USB devices are installed, what filter drivers are installed. It's kind of a, if you got it down to a 10 to 15 seconds, it's not so bad.
Mm-hmm.
It really shouldn't be much more than 5 to 10. If it's significantly longer than that, then there's a problem.
And so the end result here, if users are confused, unconfuse them.
Educate them.
Educate the users, and that's all we can do.
Without further information, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let us know if we're close, and if you need more help, Dave, let us know. All right, next question. Also on the comments from a couple hours ago, I want to use BitLocker on C drive with my current Windows 7 is installed and running very well, but I've got the problem while turning on BitLocker on C. I get the message on the first screen when I turn on BitLocker, a compatible TPM security device must be present on this computer, but a TPM was not found. Please contact your system administrator to enable BitLocker. First, let's explain what a TPM chip is in a device.
So the TPM chip is, it's a piece of hardware that stores keys for various things, and we happen to use for BitLocker.
And they're becoming more and more prevalent on laptops and mobile devices because, I mean, one of the nice things is if you have this TPM chip, you know, we can join the Microsoft network without having to have a card reader installed, mm-hmm. So we enjoy that. What are some of the other things you use a TPM chip for?
Really, right now, it's more about storing credentials securely.
Yeah.
Folks that previously had used smart cards, you can store the credentials on the TPM chip itself, so you don't have to carry on a smart card for it.
And what about the case here where he says he can't use it on a C drive?
So BitLocker has a requirement by default that says, I need a TPM chip because it's the only way securely to store those credentials.
Yeah.
So by default, we don't allow it for use on a system without a TPM chip. But there are, of course, ways around that.
Yeah.
There's a group policy within Windows that allows you to use a USB stick. So if you load up trusty gpedit.msc, the group policy editor, and then you navigate to computer configuration, admin templates, Windows components, there's BitLocker drive encryption, and then you click on the operating system drive, because in this case it's a C drive. The first option is require additional authentication on startup. So if you run that and you choose enabled, you can make this check mark that goes allow BitLocker without a compatible TPM. So what you have to have, though, is a USB key, and it has to be inserted at the time that you're booting up Otherwise, you won't be able to access your system.
And you have to have that every time you boot your system
Every single time you boot it up. So if you...
That becomes an important USB drive.
It becomes a very, very important USB drive. When you're going through the setup, it'll allow you to back it up as well. So,
yeah.
You know, if you happen to lose that drive, you're not completely hosed, but, you know, you're hosed for a little while.
And as we remember from a previous episode of Defrag, back it up.
Back it up.
Keep the backup. I didn't do it. I lost a drive.
Well, additionally, when you're going through the BitLocker setup, it'll prompt you to, it'll give you a recovery key.
Yeah.
So you can back up the key that's on your USB stick, and there's also a manual typing of a recovery key mm-hmm. that you can still get into your system if you lose everything else.
And that's a part I didn't keep. who will ever need this again?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you enable that, you know, don't lose the USB key. Run through the setup wizard again once you've enabled it and rebooted your system in order for this group policy to take effect. But after that, you should be good. There shouldn't be any issues beyond that.
Excellent. And you don't have to worry about anyone getting on your machine when you're gone. Just keep the USB drive with you.
Yep.
Or hidden somewhere.
And you should be aware that it really is a USB drive. Some people have, you know, internal SD card readers that may or may not work. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
The bus may not be up and running by the time the system is running, so a lot of SD card readers internally on systems, they require being in Windows for the driver to be loaded to access it, so it just won't work properly.
Interesting. Or it may not work. Right. It might work.
It might work. Not. It may not work.
Interesting that you could almost have like a TPM chip SD card if it did work. So,
well, I mean, that's sort of how the USB key will work, right?
Yeah.
So you can get like a really tiny it's kind of like your dongle here on your mouse. You can get a little tiny one, you know, plug that in, make it super hidden. You could have it attached to your keys. If you actually want real security, you could actually take it with you, you know, and it doesn't matter. Your machine, you know, if it gets stolen, it's like,
it's a good way to remember your keys, too.
It's a very good way to remember your keys.
I need it to use my computer.
Yep.
Excellent. All right. Next question. I've heard a lot of talk about the Morto worm, and it spreads via RDP. If I have a username and password on my system, is it at risk? What about machines I have at home that don't have a password set up on it? And what other risks do I have if I don't have a password on other machines on my home network? Can that machine be used to break into other PCs on my network that do have passwords?
So the Morto worm, as you describe, is something that takes advantage right now of remote desktop sessions.
Yeah.
The way that it works is by essentially guessing your admin password.
Mm-hmm.
So probably the best defense, well, there's two ways of doing this. You can either have a very long, strong password. You know, I tend to do this for anything that I have to password protect.
Yeah.
And I've got, you know, crazy long stuff. Passphrases is what I like to use with number or letter substitution.
Yeah.
That is a method. The other method is have a blank password, which is kind of counterintuitive, but you can't actually authenticate to a machine by default. There are ways around this if you do certain settings, but by default, your administrator user will have a blank password if you've just, you know, bought your machine from an OEM, and you go through the regular Windows setup, you notice that you have to create a new user.
Mm-hmm.
That's your, you know, everyday admin user.
Yeah.
But the administrator user itself is actually a blank password, and through normal network authentication, you can't use a blank password user.
So it's interesting. They were concerned that the machines that they have, like, you know, I've got a machine in my kitchen that I don't have a password on.
Mm-hmm.
They're concerned that that might be their weak link, but it's actually the opposite. It's stronger because you can't RDP into that machine. And
well, again, you can configure your system to allow RDP with a blank password.
Yeah.
But probably the best thing that you can do is have a very strong password, disable or rename the administrator user. You know, have a different admin user, and it won't be able to guess that.
And turn off RDP if you know you're not going to
exactly,
use it anyway.
Exactly, yeah.
Just don't run it.
Don't run it.
Yeah.
You can, there's a setting right here, if you guys aren't aware, under remote settings, you can actually, you know, mine is actually checked by default. Don't allow remote connections to this computer. Remote assistance is by default turned on.
Mm-hmm.
You can also disable that. The worm has no effect for remote assistance.
Excellent. All right, there you have it. And if you do try to RDP to this machine, does it pop up and ask you, or is it not even give you that option?
For my machine?
Yeah, because you have don't.
No, it'll just deny the connection.
Denied.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. All right. Next question. How exactly does search service work? Assume that I've got two directories on my Windows 7 workstation, C, Topic 1, with all my documents about Topic 1 in this directory and subdirectories, and C, Topic 2, with things about Topic 2. Is it possible to have an index for Topic 1 when I do my search on C, Topic 1, and another index for Topic 2, or is there only one index that I can find by default, program data, Microsoft, search, data, applications, Windows, question mark? So there's one index to rule them all.
There
right?
is one index. It would actually be kind of counterintuitive to have an index for every directory on your drive because you'd be creating indexes all the time.
Yeah, and
it really
might
small.
Even have overlap and things like
sure.
that. So that's not. But there is ways to mask your search to a single directory. I mean,
exactly.
It's Windows Explorer.
Right. So there's a link right off of Microsoft.com talking about search, and you can use the advanced query syntax to scope specifically various properties of the file system.
And this is something that you should probably go through and learn these, just or at least have a link to this. Because, I mean, it's the same thing as if you take the time to learn how to use these things with a search engine so that you can, just mm-hmm. mask to one site. Can save you a lot of time in searches. Same thing here. You can search your home machine, find files a lot faster by using these declaratives that you say, I'm looking for this author.
Exactly.
Excellent.
Yeah, and there are a ton of keywords here that, I mean, most people will probably never use.
Yeah.
But in a very large index, if you have many, many, many different types of files,
yeah.
could actually be very useful.
Yeah.
I can't begin to tell you the number of times, like, okay, I remember this keyword out of documents, right? But if it's a yeah. very common keyword, it's not going to help you. You still have to search through a whole bunch of documents.
Yeah.
So being able to scope it is very nice.
Yeah, and the simplest way for this user is if you just open up Windows Explorer, you navigate to see Topic 1, mm-hmm. and you use the search. It's
yep.
right there. It's going to mask to that directory, so yep. you're going to be fine there. It's going to do that for you automatically. You don't need any other kind of index. Excellent. All right, next question. One of my customers wanted to explore the option to move the user profile folder from the system partition to an alternative location. With XP, we had the option on the unattended XML file as below, which will allow us to specify a non-system partition. Is there anything equivalent to physically create the user profile folders for Windows 7 in a non-system partition?
You can, but we don't recommend it.
Don't do it.
The reason being is that if you do create the folder in a non-standard location or on not on the system drive, is that you won't be able to upgrade.
Yeah.
Now, I'll prefer to keep to myself what I think about upgrades, but it may be a moot point for most users because I don't think they tend to upgrade.
Yeah.
But it'll save you, if you do this. And then down the line, maybe you don't have a choice and you have to upgrade because, you've lost the installation media for some of your apps or mm-hmm. it's just too difficult in order to get your configuration back up again.
Yeah.
Or you're just moving to, assume that you had Windows Home Premium and you wanted to go to Windows Ultimate.
Yeah.
So that's an upgrade.
Yeah.
So a lot of times you don't have a choice, but you won't be able to do an upgrade because the directory isn't where it's supposed to be and we don't support it.
This reminds me of the question we had a couple weeks ago about can I put Windows in something not named C Windows? And I said, look, I've done this before. Even if you could do it, which you can't now, but even when I could do it, you regret it every day from there on out. It could be the same thing. So just shouldn't do it.
There is a KB article for it, 949977. There's far too many nines in there. That do tell you how to do it, and it's again via the unattend file. You have to download the Windows Ake or the Wake. I've talked about that one before.
Yep.
And it'll tell you what settings you can go through. But it is possible.
So
we don't,
possible, but not
best practice. There are a lot of things that are possible to do with Windows that we don't really like people
we
to do.
We traded emails on some of those things.
Oh, yeah, we did.
Sorry about that. All right, so next question. Let's get off that one. This is an interesting one. How do I pick a Wi-Fi card for my PC? What are the things I should consider, and how do I know if the drivers are going to be solid?
Well, I go to a couple of different places for my hardware. First one is, and I think a lot of people go here, is Newegg.
It's becoming a good standard for people. And they recognize this because they talk about it in their commercials.
Mm-hmm.
The best part of Newegg is customer comments and yep. feedback and ratings and things like that. So if there's a device that has problems, you're probably going to be able to determine that just from the comments there.
Yeah, and it happens, you know, relatively quickly. And, you know, people tend to be very honest about their comments. You don't see a lot of, you know, super biased one way or the other. Another place that I like to go to is Tiger Direct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're basically my go-to places for hardware when I like to buy it.
So when you're picking a Wi-Fi card, what are the things that are just mandatory for you?
For me, dual band. So the 5 gigahertz and 2.4 gigahertz band, and being able to support A, B, G, and N on both those bands, 802.11, A, B, G, and N.
Okay. Number of antennas, if it's on the back of your PC, does that matter?
Actually, it does. So, you know, if you're doing this for your PC and you're doing an add-in PCI card,
mm-hmm.
Actually having external antennas with the BMC-style connector, so you can actually... you know, take out their, you know, usually relatively flimsy, tiny antenna.
One that came with it.
And, you know, put in a nice big...
get your Pringles can, make yourself an antenna. Yeah, that kind of thing.
It's nice to have the option.
You do it. You know, you do it. Yeah.
I will neither admit nor deny.
Well, I've used some long antennas I've bought after the fact because mm-hmm. that is the problem usually. I mean, if you've got a desktop, it might be like my stuff's all rack mounted at home. It's mm-hmm. in a big metal enclosure, so that doesn't help.
Mm-hmm. A lot of places you just can't wire, you know, because obviously that's what you want to do is wire stuff, but you can't always do it. But cards that support MIMO or mm-hmm. multiple in, multiple out antennas, that right now the best you can get, as far as I understand, is 450 meg.
Yeah.
I think there are some really far out cards that can get up to 600, but they are not, you know, in mainstream use. But, you know, if you can get one that'll do at a minimum 300 megabit per second or 450 megabit per second, then, you know, you're pretty golden.
Yeah.
Brand names, I mean...
I mean, that's the other thing, too. How do you know if you're going to get a card that has solid drivers or not? I mean, the comments at Newegg or other places.
The comments are usually really good. You know, shop around. Go to the different vendors and see how often they are updating their drivers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're really updating frequently, then you have a better chance of...
If there is a problem, it's going to be fixed.
Exactly. You know, the big ones, Belkin, D-Link, Linksys, Netgear... you know, they're all really good. I don't have a general preference for any of them.
Yeah.
Because they're all pretty solid.
And I used to have really expensive networking hardware at home, and mm-hmm. when it went south, I went cheap. I got some lower end stuff, and it's worked out fine for me. So
mm-hmm.
it's one of those things. Check the ratings and things. You never know. You might be able to skimp sometimes. And speaking about this, I mean, how would you pick a wireless router? It's a little bit more complicated, but.
A wireless router, again, with external antennas,
mm-hmm.
Or the possibility for it. The type of routers that can get updated firmware with the DDWRT.
Yeah.
Those are, you know, usually more desirable because it's added features. You know, Netgear is usually the, or Netgear Linksys, which is now Cisco, are usually kind of the gold standards for those. If you can get one with more than four ports for the gigabit switch in the back, then mm-hmm. you know that's great. But you don't see that too often, other than in enterprise level or small business level routers. Routers that support VLANs and IPsec tunnels, SSL tunnels, that is really, really nice because it's, you know, built-in firewall.
Yeah.
But again, you're really paying for it. You know, you're getting up well over 200. In most cases, for
and
that.
I see some of the wireless routers that you can get say that, you know, it's got it's made for gaming,
mm-hmm.
so you can plug your Xbox.
The quality of service ones.
Yeah. So is that important if you've got an Xbox?
Yeah. No. Absolutely. If you do a lot of online gaming, then get a router that has quality of service built in.
Yeah.
And then you can.
So it's giving preference to the Xbox's traffic. So
or if you have VoIP, that's another one. You know, if you're. If you use voice over internet, either through Skype or through, you know, Magic Jack or Comcast or mm-hmm. whatever, you know, you can have preferential settings for that.
Cool. Awesome. All right. Next question. I have pinned a few apps to the taskbar and would like to run some of them as administrator when activated. Is this possible? Of course it's possible.
It is.
Here's how you do it. It will give you a couple ways.
Let's see. You can right-click on it, You can obviously just run as administrator directly.
That's way one?
That's way one. You can
go into the properties, so you right-click properties.
And then choose run as administrator. And if you do that...
And that's under the advanced icon there.
Don't really know why you'd ever want to run Media Player elevated.
Yeah.
I would never really recommend that, but that's how you do it. It's pretty simple.
And then the last way is you can just hold Control Shift and click on it.
Yes.
And it'll run it elevated too. So there's a way to do that, and that's just one time. All right, so that's that question. Next question. I have a laptop with Windows 7 Home Premium 64-bit installed, and I'm planning on upgrading it to Windows 7 Professional 64-bit. I'd like to know if it's possible, however, to revert back to Windows 7 Home Premium 64-bit once I've installed Windows 7 Professional 64-bit.
Do you want the short answer or the long answer?
Let's take both.
Okay.
Short answer first.
No.
All right.
Long answer. No.
It's not much longer of an answer.
No.
No. No.com.
For personally, I can't figure out why you'd want to.
Yeah.
But no, you don't go back in additions. If you really desperately wanted to, you'd just do a reinstall over top of Home Premium.
Yeah.
And, you know, that would forcefully do it. Again, we don't recommend doing that.
And no telling what's going to happen after that.
Again, it's one of those things that just don't make a lot of sense. If you have the thought that you actually do want to revert back, then just back up the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go through the upgrade, you find out for whatever reason you don't like it, I can't figure out why, because it's the same OS, it's just more features.
Yeah.
Then you just wipe it or restore from your backup.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. All right. Next question. This is an interesting one. I've got a main desktop at home. I'd like to watch movies using it, but be able to control it from afar. For example, I'd like to lay down and control the desktop using my own laptop via wireless. I've been looking for solutions to this question. I've tried remote desktop. Doesn't work so well. I tried to bind my desktop to my mobile phone over Bluetooth. It works, but I can't see the mouse. I can barely see the mouse pointer at a long distance. What other possibilities do I have? So I got a few suggestions for this. I mean, first of all, you can turn on mouse trails, and you can go into the Ease of Access Center, which we just did a video on that on Channel 9.
Okay.
And you can go into Ease of Access, and you can make a big cursor so that you can see it a little bit more easily. So that's one way of doing it. Yeah, here you go, Ease of Access, and it's under the Make My Mouse Easier to Use. And so you can see I've got extra large white, extra large black, and then, you know, extra large inverting. So there's a couple of ways to do that. There's even a way we talked about in the video where if you hit control, you know, it kind of sends a beacon out around the mouse so you can see it on the screen. So there's a few different options there if you want to take the easy way out. Or you can do what a lot of people do and just get a wireless media center remote. So back to Newegg. We have our Newegg link.
We do.
Our sponsor this week is Newegg. And so here you go, Rosewill, pretty cheap $25 Media Center remote. So this will give you a dongle, and this is, you know, you don't want to confuse this with a universal remote that
right,
you can program to turn your TV on or not. This is not that device. This gives you a dongle that you can plug into your machine, and you can use Media Center at a distance. So you can just take the remote, aim it towards your PC, and control it that way. That's probably the easiest way to do what he's talking about doing.
Well, again, he didn't go into a lot of details of whether he's wanting to control the entire computer or if he just wanted to control Media Center alone.
Yeah.
You know, this is, I have this system at home. You know, I use Media Center. I've got a big UI from the couch, and I use not necessarily this remote, but the receiver from this remote.
Yeah.
Excuse me, because I have a Logitech Harmony.
Harmony, yeah.
I really like that remote. I've had it for years now. And it works perfectly well connecting to that USB receiver.
Mm-hmm.
It turns on my projector and my receiver equipment.
And so you got the best of both worlds. You got the Harmony that controls all your devices, controls Media Center through the little dongle. Yeah, that's a good way of doing it. And then the other way, the way that I do things at home, is we have a Contour Shuttle, which we use these here in the studio, too. This is one of my favorite devices. And I have this this Contour Shuttle set up for all the keyboard shortcuts. So I'll use the buttons on this. So I've got this button I have, go to the next video, go to the last video, skip ahead 4 seconds, skip back 4 seconds. I've got a button for full screen. The wheel in the middle will do volume. The shuttle on the outside will scrub. So this is a heck of a great device, a little bit more pricey for someone who's not looking for these kinds of features. The nice thing with the shuttle is it has some software that will let you... It will change all the settings that it does and all the functions it has depending on which application has focus. Mm-hmm. So if I go from, like, you know, Media Player or VLC to, you know, Adobe Premiere, then I don't have to do anything. The shuttle just completely changes to almost a different device. And it's got pop-off buttons that you can label with little stickers and stuff so you know what all the buttons do. So
you know, this isn't even something that is just limited to the 10-foot UI that we're thinking of here, you know?
Yeah, well, and for that, I actually, it's funny, I have about 20 foot of USB cable in the back of this thing, and that just sits behind my PC, and when I want to go sit on the couch, I'll pull that thing over and, you know, load up a playlist, and there you go. So that's one of the ways that I do it. So lots of different options for you there, but interesting question.
Looks also good for little hands, too. You know, if you have kids, it looks like something that they can... actually manage.
Yeah, my kids actually know what all the buttons do, and so they can do all the things they need to. Hmm. Excellent. Next question. In my university, there's a big Wi-Fi network, which is covered by different access points, antennas, which all share the same SSID. One of these access points doesn't work. It's either broken or misconfigured, and usually the network card software has software to set the advanced features, but not this one. Do you guys know any utility which I can use to specify on Windows 7 which access point from all those available to connect to?
Oddly enough, we have it built in. So I'm on wireless right now. This obviously won't work if you're not on wireless. But if you click on it, you go to Open Network and Sharing Center. And what you do is you click on your big network that you are currently connected to.
So it's the picture. Your active network.
And then you have the set network properties. And right here is merge or delete network locations. And this will bring up a list of your SSIDs. And you can, you know, delete which ones that you don't want to connect to anymore if you have multiple SSIDs and or merge them.
Merge a couple together, yeah.
Yep.
Nice.
And this will potentially clear up that issue if it is, in fact, a misconfigured access point. Although probably a simpler thing to do would be to contact your university.
Tell them to fix it.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's likely not just this one user having issues.
Yeah.
And... you know, while it's cool to be able to fix it yourself, you're not really doing anyone else any favors.
Yeah. Excellent. All right, next question. I have a big problem with my netbook. It doesn't see any Wi-Fi network. The problem is the PC uses Windows 7 Starter. The Wi-Fi card is activated. I updated the drivers. The Ethernet card is activated, too. When I plug in an Ethernet cable, the netbook can go out on the web. When I want to show all Wi-Fi networks, I see nothing. When I want to add manually a Wi-Fi network, I get an error. I can't ping the gateway of my personal network. My other computer can connect, and I don't know how to resolve this problem. It's amazing. I had this problem last night. And I saw all these things. I had updated all the drivers and stuff like this. It was a laptop that I did a fresh install of Windows 7 Ultimate on.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did is I went to the manufacturer's site and downloaded all the latest drivers and installed all of them. I installed a Wi-Fi driver that actually broke the Wi-Fi. I mean, the wireless didn't work anymore, and it looked like it was working. It looked like everything was fine with it.
Mm-hmm.
When I diagnosed it, it said, you know, check your router, but it just wouldn't show any of the Wi-Fi networks. It was that driver, and it turned out that it was a driver. It was made for Vista,
mm-hmm.
and the Windows 7 driver had worked when I installed Windows 7.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did is I just did a system restore to go back to the day before I installed that driver,
mm-hmm.
and everything worked smashingly. So that was the problem there. I would try that. I would try to roll back that driver, uninstall that driver,
mm-hmm.
and do a system restore if you can just to get back to how it was before that. Because, you know, the Windows 7... install, it was tested on a lot of hardware,
mm-hmm.
and it's likely that that's going to be a better option for you than going out and installing an old Vista driver. And if it works, don't try to fix it.
Yeah, so, that is definitely one of those times where updated drivers are not necessarily the best possible thing.
Yeah.
You should always check to see, you know, when you've done a clean install, do you have any yellow bangs or red bangs in Device Manager?
Yeah.
You know, if there's nothing to update... and everything is working great,
yeah,
then maybe you don't touch anything.
Yeah, and I mean, if I would have clicked on Windows Update and I saw there's a wireless update for this machine and it got pushed down, that probably would have been fine. I would have gone with that. But I probably should have looked and not tried to, you know, reinvent the wheel when I went to the manufacturer's site and grabbed a Vista driver and tried to install that on the machine. That's where everything started going south for me. So I would try that first. Next question, I brought a new SSD and installed Windows on it, and I kept my old hard drive attached in the case in case he needs it. However, even if I don't use anything on that hard drive, I still hear it making noises. This happens especially when I change the program that I'm using, even when the programs and files I'm using are all on the SSD. The noise is not a problem. The problem is that whenever the hard drive is making noise, everything is slow. After using this same program for a minute or two, the hard drive stops making noise and everything is smooth again. What could be causing this? That's almost like a bad hard drive, possibly.
Well, it kind of begs the question of, you know, why he switched out the drive to begin with. Was it going south originally?
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, we can't tell what is accessing it without actually investigating what is accessing it.
And what would you use for that?
Process monitor.
Yeah.
You know, if the drive is clearly showing up correctly, then you can scope to activity based on processes by setting the path. So one of the options when you're filtering is to choose a path and say, you know, just concentrate on D drive or E drive or whatever it is that drive letter is.
Yeah.
And then you can see what processes are acting on it. It could be a search indexer. It could be your antivirus. It could be any number of things. But, you know, honestly, if the drive isn't doing anything,
mm-hmm.
and it's not needed, then pull it. I mean, why waste the power trying to power it if you're not going to access anything?
And, I mean, if you pull it, it doesn't mean you don't have to use it. You could always have an external enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go grab a cheap external enclosure and just plug it up if you need it.
Yep.
But, yeah, if you don't need it and you're not using it, there's no reason to have that in there.
Right.
One of the things that, and we talked about this before, is I had a lot of external drives I had connected to my computer. And sometimes when I boot, you know, it just takes longer to boot up and it's looking at those drives and stuff. So I just unplug them all. If I need them, I plug them in. So.
Mm-hmm.
Can make it a little faster.
Interesting way for that is, I'm assuming you use it through a USB hub. So you plug everything
yes.
to an external
yep.
USB hub. Then you just, you know, either plug in or unplug the entire hub.
Yeah.
Then you don't have to worry about it. You don't
yeah.
have to worry about the entire system. And you plug it in and, you know, the machine will just
yeah.
go through and enumerate everything as you need
Good
it.
Good idea. I could take all the devices I'm not using, not just drives, but everything.
Everything.
Just plug that in when I need it.
I'd recommend a powered USB hub.
Yes. Yes. Excellent. All right. Let's see here. Pick of the week. Pick of the week. So this is from howtogeek.com. And it's something interesting that you might not have tried before. There's just a simple way. You can drag and drop different applications, sites, all kinds of things into your favorites. So this is a favorites that shows up on Windows Explorer. You just click on favorites there. You can see all the things that that Gove uses here. But you can also drag your favorite applications.
You can do network shares.
Yep.
You know, so if I wanted to drag that, probably this guy.
Drag it into your Bing search.
There you go.
There you go.
You know, I can now close that, start up again. I'll always have it click on it, and I can get to that machine in this case, or you can do the individual shares.
Yeah.
Which is really handy.
Yeah, so I'd never really used favorites, so when I saw this, I was like, well, you know, I could drop that in there. Normally when I see favorites, I'm thinking like websites and stuff, but you know, this could be anything. It could be the apps that you use all the time, so it can save you some time there. It can be directories that you're always going into.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have lots of work directories that I always pop into. So yeah, this will a little article that'll tell you how to put these things in, and it's very simple.
You can even rename it to, you know, something more descriptive than
yeah.
You know, for servers or shares that might be named something weird.
Yeah.
You know, and you access it, but, you know, you always have to think about the name all the time.
Yeah.
You can rename it to be whatever you like.
Excellent. All right, so that's Pick of the Week, and that's the show for this week. Thank you, Gove. And if you have any questions, defrag, you can send email to defragshow@microsoft.com, or you can leave a comment in the show notes here, and we'll keep an eye on that. And see you next week.